This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to Good Things, a show where we talk to good people who are doing good things. I'm Darshan Johan. 22-year-old Hassan Al-Akra was born in Aleppo, Syria. In 2012, he and his family had to leave their war-torn home country to seek refuge. Today, Hassan is a teacher and an activist fighting for refugee rights. He joins us on the show to share his journey, struggles, and the time where he was placed in a detention center when he was merely a kid. Welcome to the show, Hassan. So, Hassan, your home country is Syria. How old were you when you left your home country and why did you decide to leave?
Thank you so much for having me. So I was 12 years old when my family and I decided to leave Syria. And the war in Syria started in 2011. And at that time, when the war first started, it wasn't as dangerous as it became in the next few years. So at that time, it started in cities that were a bit far from our city. We were living in Aleppo. We are from Aleppo. We were living in a village that is near the borders of Turkey.
Right.
And we had a very good life. We had everything. I felt like we had everything. My siblings and I would go to school. We had our own farm, sheep, goats, cow, everything. And, you know, everything we eat fresh. We had our own house, large two floors bungalow house in the village that we own. My father had a good job and we had a good life, just like anybody else. For me, that was like the happiest life I could ever ask for. But then in just a blink of an eye, everything turned upside down when the war started. And then it slowly reached Aleppo, where we were living. And we started seeing bombs flying above our village and hitting the village next to us. And we could see the destruction right in front of our eyes. There were moments where we had to go hide underground in the basement where our sheep and goats are staying. So we had to go, and there were nights where we had to stay there to protect ourselves from the bombs. And then my family decided that it is best for us to leave the country for now and bring us to a safer place. I'm very, very grateful that my dad made the right choice at that time. A lot of people ask why Malaysia. Right. The only reason is that in 2006, way before the war, there was a Malaysian family who used to stay in Syria. They were studying in Syria.
Right.
It's a whole family, mom, dad, and they had five children. So we met them at a mosque. We become close friends. They can speak Arabic. And, you know, that was easier for us to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we slowly clicked and we became really close friends. We invited them to our home. They invited us to their home. And then they started struggling financially a little bit. So we took them to stay with us in our home.
Right.
For at least 2 years. And then the wife completed her studies and then returned to Malaysia. So when the war started, 2011, of course, we kept in touch mm-hmm. throughout those years. And, you know, they saw the news and they asked us, you know, why don't you come here? It's safer here. And that's when we decided to come to Malaysia. So at that time, we didn't know anything about Malaysia. We know a little bit of information, but we don't know what it is to live in Malaysia. But we were very grateful that this family welcomed us from the airport. We stayed at their house for a few weeks and then we moved out to somewhere near to where they lived. And they basically taught us everything about the Malaysian culture, the traditions, the language.
How did you travel to Malaysia exactly? What was the journey like? And did you run into trouble or did you face challenges on your way here?
For a lot of Syrians or those who are coming from countries that is like in the Middle East or like Afghanistan and so on, the only, I would say, passage to actually reach Malaysia is through a flight.
Right.
Flight, not by boat.
Mm-hmm.
So my family, we booked flight ticket. We got our passport done. And at that time, we were grateful that we left a bit early before the situation got worse. At that time, the airport was still open. So the journey actually from Aleppo to the international airport of Damascus, that journey was very difficult. It was
right.
very traumatizing. Like on our way in the bus, we looked from the window and we saw houses destroyed, bombed, schools and hospitals destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
We even saw dead bodies on the ground and blood everywhere. And you know, looking at that scenes as we are leaving hometown, the thoughts in my head as a 12-year-old child were mainly about, why am I leaving?
Right.
This is my country. This is my homeland. I should stand there, I should fight for it, I should protect it. Why are we living?
Right.
And the amount of anger in my heart, the amount of sadness and grief as I'm living, as we bid farewell to my grandma and our relatives and our close friends and family, we are saying goodbye without knowing when will we ever see them again or if we will ever see them again. The journey was very difficult. It was very sad, and it was, of course, very dangerous. There were a lot of checkpoints throughout the journey. It was about a seven-hour journey. There were many, many checkpoints where they checked our luggage, they checked our passport and everything. But we're glad that, you know, we reached the airport safely, and we waited at the airport. And the scenes at the airport at the time was just horrific. There were so many people just trying any way they can to leave the country. There were so many people at the airport that we even made some, you know, we made some conversation at some people with some people at the airport, and there were people there who were already refugees from another country. There were refugees from Iraq, from Pakistan. There were migrant workers from Uzbekistan who came to Syria to work and survive. And now the war has started. You know, they have to go move another country. Right. So I couldn't imagine at that time what it's been like for them having to be a refugee twice, having to go through the whole journey twice or three times. But of course, we never expected, like if you ask us, you know, 2006, 2007, that one day we'll become refugees and we will come to Malaysia, I will say that is impossible. But that's exactly what happened. So we came by flight and we came as a tourist with a visa. Once we arrived, we went to the UNHCR office in Malaysia and we registered as refugees. So at the time when we arrived, the process for refugees in Malaysia to register to UNHCR was a bit different than now. At that time, we had to go through several interviews. They had to do several screening processes to ensure that we are actually legitimate to receive the refugee status. We're thankful that after at least a year of us waiting and after interview, we finally got the UNHCR card. But we didn't know what these UNHCR cards could mean to us as a refugee in Malaysia. What value does it have on us? What does the law say about us here in the country?
What happened next? Was it easy for you, whether it's you, your family members, other people in your community, to get access to healthcare and education in Malaysia? What happens when someone in your family or community gets sick or pregnant, for example?
Actually, when we arrived, my mom was 8 months pregnant. So I have a brother who was born in Malaysia, and now he's almost 10 years old. Yeah. So you see, because the Malaysian government did not sign the United Nations High Commission for Refugees Convention in 1951, or the protocol, refugees who come to Malaysia are not granted these rights. UNHCR in Malaysia operate on a humanitarian basis. So the government of Malaysia allowed UNHCR to open an office here and process refugees on kindness basis, right? No law, no formal convention whatsoever. Now, Malaysia is supposed to be a transit country for refugees. So refugees come here, and they were supposed to be here just for a short amount of time, and then they get resettled to another country, or they, you know, return to their home country if the situation becomes better. But because a lot of countries have closed their doors into accepting refugees, and their resettlement process, the UNHCR resettlement process, is only less than 1% a year, refugees have been stuck here for years. I've met refugees from Rohingya who are even second generation in Malaysia. There are parents who have children who now have children as well, and they're still waiting on resettlement because the situation in their home country have not improved. So the laws in Malaysia, because the convention is not signed, refugees are not allowed to work legally. Mm-hmm. Refugees are not allowed to access public education. Mm-hmm. And healthcare, they can access government healthcare. One thing that I have to thank the government for is giving 50% discount for any refugee who has a UNHCR card or the UC letter. So, but this does not apply to all types of treatment. And of course, it has its limitation as well, because even after the 50% discount, their bill remains very, very expensive.
Right.
Like you can deliver a baby, and even after the discount, you still have to pay 2,500 to 3,000 ringgit.
Right.
So if you don't allow refugees to work, how do you expect them to pay for this? Mm-hmm. And if we were to speak about housing, there are no shelters or camps in Malaysia. Refugees have to rent houses and pay for the rent. So if we also expect them to pay rent and not end up homeless in the street, you know, how are they going to get that money? So that's when a lot of refugees work illegally. They are willing to risk being arrested and detained and in some cases deported back to their home country because the situation is desperate. They need to put food on the table. They need to feed their children. They need to pay rent. They need to pay all these medical expenses that, you know, whenever they get sick or need surgeries or whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So the laws are there and, you know, refugees know the law, but, you know, how do you expect them to survive? Like it or not, they have to break the law because they need to survive, mm-hmm. right? So, and yeah, of course, the risk of them getting arrested and detained is there, but a lot of them are willing to sacrifice that risk because they have to survive.
What about education? Because you came here when you were a kid and you said your mom was 8 months pregnant, your brother grew up here. How did you and your brother, you know, attend school?
So I have five siblings. Right. I'm the third.
Okay.
When we arrived in Malaysia, the Malaysian family that I mentioned earlier, who were our friends, they took us to a government school nearby where we used to live, where their children used to study there. They took us, all four of my siblings, to, you know, try and register. So of course, you know, the school did not accept us because we're not Malaysians, we're not Warga Negara. But the principal, I still remember him, he was so kind. He was such a kind person. He said, it's okay. You can come to school. You sit at the back of the class every day, just like any other students, but only to listen to learn the language, right? Just to learn the language, nothing else. We are not allowed to take the exams. We're not allowed to do, you know, homework. We're not allowed to have books. Just to listen, learn the language.
Right.
Which for us, we felt so grateful for. We were so happy. At least, you know, almost 2 years of missing school, you know, we finally being back to school was very helpful. So we attended that school and I forgot to mention to you earlier that when we arrived in Malaysia, we only knew Arabic.
Right.
No English, no Malay, nothing. Only Arabic. So for us to adjust into the culture and for us, if I have to mention to you the struggle we had at the school trying to have friends, trying to speak with locals was very, very challenging.
Right.
But there were some students who can speak Arabic a little bit. So we had, you know, connection. And in about 2 weeks, you know, we liked it, but then it got a bit, not suitable in a way that, you know, we were bullied a lot of times because we didn't know the language and we were called names. And in that 2 weeks, honestly, I've learned the basic, but I've also learned all the Malaysian bad words. And the first one I learned was mat kau,
right?
Like, which means your mother is green, which for me was like, okay, I was trying to find the translation. Then after I found the translation, I was like, okay, how is it bad to call it, you know, and why is it a bad thing? And then I had to look at that video where, you know, the whole, this word started. Mm. So, and then we left the school after about 2-3 weeks. And then we just stayed at home and we started then watching TV, drama TV Tiga, drama TV Satu. And you know, we started learning Malay from there. We read newspaper, we listen to Malaysian songs. You know, all these helped us to learn Malay language. So now all five of my siblings are fluent in Malay language and English as well. And this is all because of, you know, actually, you know, connecting with people, making friends with locals, watching TV and all that.
Right. So how has it been for you and your siblings in terms of, let's say, finding a job? You know, because you all have been here for many, many years. But like you said, Malaysia supposedly is a transit country for our refugees. But you and your family have been here for years. So what has that experience been like?
So when we first arrived, my father found a job at a restaurant in one of the universities and as a cook, right? So he started working as a chef, although it was illegal, but, you know, we had no choice.
Right.
And then a few months later, his health condition becomes bad. He had kidney stones, so he had to stop working. And that's when me and my eldest brother decided to work and support the family. So we went and we worked at restaurants as well.
And how old were you, sorry, when
I was 12. That
when
was
you started
like
working?
In the same year when we arrived in Malaysia, yes. So I was 12 and my eldest brother was 15 or 16 years old at that time. So we started working in the restaurant and I didn't care because I wanted to help my family, of course, but it was very difficult because that's the first time in my whole life to me to work actually. Yeah. And so I started as, you know, washing dishes, cleaning tables, and then I work in the kitchen, cutting vegetables and, you know, assisting the chefs. And then, you know, throughout this, at least for 2 years doing that, until 2014, I have improved myself. I've learned the skills of working in a restaurant and, you know, doing all restaurant things. And that's when my boss really liked me and he then promoted me to be the cashier of the restaurant.
Like, right. Nice.
Which for me was very, like, it was a very good, like, okay, yeah. there's a fan next to me. There's, you know, I get to talk to customers and people. So working as a cashier was also a new skill for me, but you know, I'm grateful that I had that experience. But then the sad thing that happened was in 2014, one of the days when I was working as a cashier in a restaurant, immigration came and raided the place. So I was sitting behind the cashier counter and then, you know, this, group of men came in and asked for, you know, documents and passport. At that time I had my UNHCR card with me. So I showed them my UN card and they say, oh, you're a refugee. You're not allowed to work here. And then they put me aside and then they, you know, they checked everybody else, all the other workers. And then, you know, they put us in a truck. Everybody who was a UNHCR card holder or any migrant who was undocumented or their visa was expired, they were all put in a truck. And it was a raid in the whole university. Like that university had about 28 restaurants. So they went into all 28 restaurants. And my brother was in one of those restaurants as well. So he was also arrested.
Right.
So we were brought to the immigration detention center in Bukit Jalil. And that's when we had to stay for, I stayed for 9 days. UNHCR then released me. But this was after my employer paid a fine. He had to pay a fine for hiring a refugee because it's against the law to hire a refugee. On the other hand, my brother stayed for 25 days. So this experience in detention, unfortunate thing that happened. It is a sad thing that happened, but I'm also grateful that it happened for a reason. It led me to where I am today.
On the show with me today is Hassan Al-Akra, Syrian refugee and an activist. After the break, I ask him what it was like for him as a child placed in a detention center. We'll be back with more on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan and on the show with me today is Hassan Al-Akra, Syrian refugee and an activist. So Hassan, what was it like for you as a child seeing authorities coming to the restaurants, checking all of these documents and then bringing you all to the truck and then keeping you there for 9 days? As a child, what was going through your mind at that time?
I was, of course, traumatized. In my head, when they handcuffed me, in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? I only see this in the movies.
Right.
I only see this on TV. You know, why is it happening to me now? Did I kill somebody? Did I, you know, what crime have I done? That was the question in my head. What crime have I done? And when the officers were communicating with me and I was communicating with them in Malay and, you know, they told me that, okay, you ni pelarian, you tak boleh kerja kat sini. Like, yes, they're saying these words. I understand these words, but it's not making sense to me. Right? Like, why a refugee cannot work? So, you know, in my mind, you know, as they put us in the truck and inside detention is even worse. They put us in a cell. I was put in a cell with another about 25 other people. The condition of the detention center itself is to the point where I would rather just die than living in that condition. If I get thirsty and I need to drink water, I have to drink from the toilet tube that tastes like Clorox. And the food that was given to us, it's twice a day, white rice and fried fish the size of a finger, and sometimes a little bit of vegetables on the side, twice a day, which this is not even enough to feed a cat, let alone a human being. So I was constantly 24 hours hungry. All of us in that detention, 24 hours hungry. We all had to sleep on the ground. There were so many insects, the blood-sucking bugs inside there. We couldn't even see the sunlight. I pray every day and I ask God, like, take me away from here. I don't want to be here. But the most shocking thing that I've learned there is on my third day of being inside there, a new batch of detainees arrived. And amongst these, there were three kids who were from Rohingya. And they were younger than me. I was 14. These kids were 11, 12, 13 years old. And they were from Rohingya. They just arrived by the boat a few days ago. So, you know, when I look at them, you look at their eyes, you could see what a horrible journey they have gone through. We tried, me and the other detainees, we tried to comfort them. They were crying. We tried to comfort them. And, you know, we tried to communicate with them as well. There were Rohingyas with us in the cell who can speak Malay and English. They were translating. One of them, his father was beheaded in front of his eyes back in their hometown in Myanmar. The other one, his whole house, his entire village was burned down by the military. And they were put on a boat, and they spent almost a month or more on the sea with very little food. And if you look at their chest, you could see the bones. That's how hungry they were. So for me at that time, looking at them, hearing their story, it made me realize, you know, how cruel this world can be to children,
right,
like me and others. But it also made me realize how fortunate I am to at least have my family here in Malaysia with me. How fortunate I am to at least have a document, a UNHCR card that I know will release me soon. But they don't have any document. They have nothing. They have lost their parents. They're just alone here. So that at that time, I said, okay, I should stop complaining. It is what it is. I'm in detention. So what? Let me just, you know, I'll just keep it to God. In Arabic, we say tawakkal, like leave it to God. And so me and those three kids, we become friends, you know, for the next few days. And then on the ninth day, when immigration announced my number, my body number, I was being released. I felt very happy. I don't know how even to describe it. I was very happy to, like, finally I'm going to see my family. Finally, I'm going to be out of this place. But also sad because I'm leaving them behind, those three kids. They are children. They deserve to go to school. They deserve to play. They deserve to be outside. They do not deserve to be in such a place. So I felt sad. And, you know, I went home. Of course, this whole experience in detention is just traumatizing. And up until this point, I still go to therapy. And I still, you know, like, the trauma is not forgotten. It is there. But I've just learned how to cope with it better. A few days after I was released, I went, you know, I was home, and in my mind, okay, what's next? What am I going to do next?
Right.
And that's when, you know, I've been always passionate about teaching. I've always, right, since I was very young, I've always loved teaching, and I've always loved, you know, advocating for what is right. Mm-hmm. So I told myself, you know, this story deserves to be told. The story of these three children who are still there in detention center deserve to be told to the world. And hopefully, I don't know, policymakers will listen or not. At least I've done my part and I've told them. So that's when I started volunteering at refugee schools, right, teaching refugee children. That time I was 15 years old. So it was also, you know, I had a lot to learn. So I'm very grateful that I learned a lot from so many powerful people in this country who are advocating for this cause. And slowly I started participating in conferences and meetings where I shared the story, and I shared the story of these three children. I spoke at TEDx Malaysia as well a few times, and I had a few parliamentary meetings with members of parliament where, you know, I advocated for this. But, you know, it's very sad that I'm not the only one doing it, and I'm not the first one to do it. There have been, for years, NGOs and activists in Malaysia, mm-hmm, have been advocating for the to end child detention in Malaysia. I mean, end detention at all, but right, more importantly, children, and to no avail. So just recently, the Malaysian government announced the ATD pilot, Alternative to Detention, yep, where they are planning to release some children into, mm-hmm, community centers instead of detention. But we are yet to see an update. This has been going for a year, so I'm hopeful.
Yeah, it's so inspiring to hear this, right? Because what you went through is, you know, it really makes my stomach churn. And you know, you got into activism at the age of 15. when, you know, most kids are just, you know, living their lives and being kids and playing football and just running around and not worried about anything. They're not worried about the sufferings of the world and what people are going through and politics and all of that. But you started to get into it at the age of 15. You also founded the Al Hassan Volunteer Network in 2016, pretty much to reach out to and empower refugee communities. Tell me about the organization and the work that you guys do.
So when I started teaching at all these refugee schools and I started taking part in conferences and meetings and advocacy work, I then, you know, thought it's all over the place. All the work, all the projects I was doing, it's all over the place. I don't have an initiative. I don't have an umbrella where I can keep everything together. And I had a whole team of volunteers. I had a whole team. But what are we? That's what started, you know, the question. So I have a friend, Farhana from Singapore, who also was an active volunteer with us, and she, you know, took this initiative to start this organization. And we chose the name Al Hassan, which means the goodness in Arabic, the goodness. So it's basically the Goodness Volunteer Network. We are not registered. We're just a small initiative. We have a lot of volunteers. It's run on a voluntary basis. We're non-profit, but we're doing a lot of programs that focuses on education. So we do tuition classes for refugee children. We organize trips to bring children to watch a movie from time to time. We take them to the park to play sports. And we also organize skills classes for their parents, women and men, like cooking, baking, IT, technology, marketing, and all those skills that will help them gain something and, you know, have an opportunity to apply somewhere. And then from there, I also started an initiative, which now has become an organization on its own. It's called Refugee Emergency Fund, REF. Mm. So Refugee Emergency Fund, I started it as a small, just a WhatsApp group of some donors and some caseworkers who, every time there's a case of a refugee admitted at the hospital and they need to pay the deposit or they need to pay help to pay the bill, you know, we send it in this WhatsApp group and that's when, you know, people donate. But it slowly grew. It grew into something I've never expected it would be. Now it's a whole organization. It has its own board of directors. It has its own committee members. It has its own staff members and has its own, you know, but entirely funded by the public. Everything is funded through fundraising. So every time a case comes to us, so we take in medical. So any refugee who needs medical assistance to pay the bill for their surgeries or so on. Rental, if anyone is getting evicted from their home and because they couldn't afford to pay rent, or if anyone is homeless and they want to rent a new house, we fundraise to pay their deposit. And as well as, you know, food, education, and also most importantly, I think it's also important is burial. When a refugee passed away, they still have to pay close to 2,000 ringgit.
Right.
So even after you die, you still have to pay something. You know, that's when REF comes in. That's when the Refugee Emergency Fund comes in. That's when our team comes in to do fundraising appeal. We send it, all fundraising we do it through social media or all of our social media platforms. And that's when people start donating. And then REF is now, we're using an organization bank account under Al Ikhlas Hope Society. It is director of Al Ikhlas is a committee member in REF. So REF is like a project of Al Ikhlas technically. But yeah, it is like an organization on its own, just for formality and to have a proper bank account. See, I'm very grateful that it's going. Like, there were times when we had zero funding, but we still take on the case and we just posted on social media and never once did we not reach the target within the needed
deadline. That's fantastic.
We have taken on very large cases. We have 4 cases of refugee children who are diagnosed with cancer and their treatment is like at least for 3-5 years treatment. And the cost is 80 to 150,000 ringgit. It varies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, We even take on those cases because, you know, they have nowhere else to go. And I'm very grateful. This is one thing I love about Malaysia is that, you know, people donate. You can have somebody who hates having refugees here and still donate to a refugee who needs help. This is always surprising to me, but, you know, there's a sense of humanity. Of course, there needs to be more education and awareness and all that. But at least the sense of humanity is there. they see somebody in need of help, they help. Mm-hmm. And that's how, yeah, this REF have been ongoing. So HBN, the Al-Hassan Community Network, and REF is among the two things that I've started and still ongoing until now. So I'm very grateful.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And you're an activist, you're a teacher. The thing about activism, right, is that, I mean, you definitely know this, it's that you go through and you face many defeats. More often than not, it's more defeats than victories. Just, you know, pushing for certain policy changes. You've given talks here, talks there, talk to this politician, engage parliamentarians. And sometimes things don't move at all. Sometimes it moves at snail's pace. What keeps you going despite these various defeats, despite the challenges that you've faced and still continue to face? Why do you keep doing this instead of just focusing on yourself?
Very good question. I would say it's the impact. I'll give you an example. So, for example, there was this project that I was part of, founded by Dr. Gladys, a very good friend of mine, called Tiny Gold Heart Project, TGHP. The whole purpose of this project is to fundraise for refugee children who need heart surgeries in Malaysia. UNHCR gave us a list of children who need these heart surgeries. They gave it to Dr. Gladys and said, hey, can you help those kids?
Right.
So she brought me in. And then, you know, me and her and a few other team members, we started, you know, this project where we fundraise, but it's only specific to refugee children who need heart surgeries. Mm-hmm. And again, the fundraising was all through social media. And one heart surgery, you know, the cost could be 80 to 100 plus thousand ringgit, which is very expensive. But, you know, that is the cost of saving a heart. And I'm very grateful for IGN, Institute of Jantunegara, the surgeons there, who a lot of them have deducted their fees as a surgeon. And then, you know, they were very cooperative, very supportive of this project as well. So we closed the project just last week. On Sunday last week, we had an event where we brought in all the surgeons, all the doctors, all the partners, the NGOs, and also the children and their families who have done the heart surgeries from 2 years until now. So we did this event to, you know, thank everybody, appreciate everyone, and also to close the project officially. And looking at the children that we have supported, and we have, you know, through just taking on the case, through just helping them, you know, saying yes to them and, you know, leaving the rest to the public to help or not, you know, and then looking at the children now being healthy and you know, playing around, you know, they were running on stage, they were disrupting the whole event, but, you know, seeing them active like that, that is what, you know, keeps me going.
Right.
And if I can mention one case particularly, there was this baby called Arman, baby Arman from mm-hmm. Rohingya, was born with a congenital heart disease. And he needed a surgery, but this was in a hospital in Johor. They reached out to us. The hospital contacted us. They contacted UNHCR. UNHCR cannot support. They don't have funding. They contacted many other organizations. Everybody said no. And then to which finally the doctors decided, okay, we will release the child to his family and, you know, he will die peacefully in a few days. But the doctors also told us that, you know, there's a very high chance that this surgery will be successful if done. It just needs 75,000 ringgit. And the surgery is 2 days later. 2 days. And the most difficult part was the decision, not the fundraising, the decision of us actually saying yes or no. And the doctor, in our team, they told us what they think as a doctor. As a doctor, they say this case has a very high chance of successful. He can grow up to be a healthy child if this surgery can be done. It's only one surgery compared to other children who have to go through 3-4 right. surgeries. This is only one. At that time, we also had 4 ongoing fundraisings, 4 other children who had ongoing fundraisings. So without, you know, and then, so medically, they told me everything. Now, as someone who's handling the fundraising, I have to give
right.
an answer, yes or no. And having to make that decision itself for a life, a child, a life, was very difficult for me. But, right. you know, then I look back at every case we have received before that, you know, although we had no money at all, we just said yes and we put it up on social media and you know, every time, you know, we never regretted it. So I say, why not, you know, we do it the same. So we put out the appeal, and surprisingly, within one day, we did not just manage to raise 75,000, we managed to raise 140,000, double the amount, which helped us to pay the surgery for two more children. And that baby, you know, had a success. They brought him all the way from Johor to IJN, had a successful surgery, was discharged and was sent back home to Johor. And they attended, they came to the event last week. And, you know, I seeing the baby just made me, you know, very happy.
Yeah.
And made me realize, you know, that, you know, the impact that we're doing through small, small things.
Yeah.
But also I did, you know, there are moments where, of course, I lose hope. There are moments where I do not want to continue. Believe me or not, 2 days after this event that we did on Sunday, one of the children who did the heart surgery 4 months ago passed away. He was 7 years old. So supposedly the heart surgery should be done when they are babies, when they're toddlers. Mm. The chances of success is higher. But because his family, no one knew that he had a heart condition until 2019. At that time, it was a bit too late and it was risky to do the surgery, but parents had hope, you know. Doctors consulted them many times and they still opted to go with the surgery, the parents. So, and, you know, 4 months after the surgery, only he passed away. So me and Dr. Gladys, we went to the cremation of the body, and, you know, that moment itself was very sad for us, that, you know, a child that we just met a few days ago and he was happy and healthy just to suddenly pass away was very tragic. And so, you know, there are moments like that that make me feel I want to stop. I want to give up. Yeah, I guess there's no standard thing. There's no standard feeling that I have. No, there's no standard thing that I have to follow to keep me going. It just, you know, I live day to day. I wake up every day excited what's going to happen next, and, you know, just leave the rest to God and to the public to support.
Yeah. Hassan, you've faced massive struggle and you have done fantastic work over the years. What are your future plans? Because you've been here for many, many years now. What next for Hassan Al-Akra?
Well, I'm very optimistic. I have high hopes, but, you know, you never know. I mean, last month I finished my bachelor's degree, and this was through a private university, a scholarship that I received from private university, which I'm very, very grateful for. And so, yeah, I took a degree in education, and I've just finished last month, and my graduation is next month, 22 July.
Congratulations.
So much. So next would be, you know, I'll just continue working and, you know, see what's going to happen next. Either we, you know, settle to another country or hopefully go back to Syria if the situation there becomes better. But if we do go back to Syria, I want to do something. Like I want to work at the Ministry of Education you know, create more inclusive curriculum, more supportive curriculum to the children of my country. Like, I love teaching, but I also love educational policies, creating policies relating to education and special education and all that. So, yeah, that's the main goal. But for now, yeah, I'll continue doing the work I do until God decides the next plan for me.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. I wish you all the best. Before we wrap this conversation up, Hassan, would you have a final message for us?
Whenever I share my story, I do not want people to feel that I am ungrateful to Malaysia. It's the total opposite. I consider Malaysia like my second home. I love Malaysia just as much as I love Syria because I grew up here the same amount of years as I lived in Syria.
Right.
And for me, Malaysia is, you know, I love Malaysia so much. All of my friends are Malaysian. I love the Malaysian food. I can speak the local language. My whole family, we've adapted into the culture here. We do consider Malaysia as a second home, no matter what the law says about us. We feel that we belong to Malaysia somewhat. So my message is that, you know, when we look at refugees, let's be more humane, let's be more considerate, let's show more empathy and sympathy. And if we really want to understand more about refugees, don't listen to the policymakers, don't listen to the media, you know, to some media outlets. Go out, meet refugees, speak with them by yourselves. And try to help as much as you can. You can volunteer, you can raise awareness, you can use your social media to help us share fundraising appeals. You can go to refugee schools and volunteer there. There's so many ways where you can help. And it's all about tolerance, and it's all about accepting and being more inclusive in this society.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Hassan. That was Hassan Al-Akra, Syrian refugee and an activist. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can also check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.